From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, Shanana Gushmao, in his first interview with the U.S. media given to Amy Goodman and Alan Nairn, the East Timorese resistance leader talks about his country's road to freedom. Also, human rights defenders under fire in Colombia. We will speak with activists who risk their lives every day in the name of justice. All that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now! I'm Robert Knight. Hear the news. Israeli Foreign Minister Ariel Sharon today proposed creation of a national unity government in order to postpone elections in May and find a way to end Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon. Sharon may have brought the idea forward in part to compete against a pledge by the Labor Party leader Ehud Barak that if he were elected in the May 17th vote, he would bring Israeli troops home within a year. Barak placed the debate over Israel's 17-year occupation in southern Lebanon at the heart of the election campaign. Within Israel, there's growing frustration over the guerrilla war, where 901 Israeli soldiers have died since 1982. This year, seven Israelis have been killed in ambushes and roadside bombings by Hezbollah. And in an attempt to take back the initiative in the election campaign, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he would also try to pull troops out within a year, but he would not commit to a date. In a television interview Tuesday evening, the Prime Minister did invite Barak to present his plan to the cabinet. Indonesia has launched a major troop buildup in the provincial capital, and soldiers are firing warning shots to prevent continuing conflict between Christians and Muslims. That happened in a church in coastal Ambon, and it blocked hundreds of Muslim refugees, some of them carrying knives, who tried to approach Christian protesters from a nearby mosque. That's only part of the trouble facing Indonesia. There is also unrest in East Timor, where people are fleeing by the thousands in anticipation of potential violence. That comes after the debate in which the Jakarta government announced that it would contemplate releasing the former Portuguese colony that it occupied militarily in 1975. In Beijing, people who were wounded or who lost family members when the army quelled the Tiananmen Square protests have appealed for compensation and an investigation into that military crackdown. In a letter to China's president, the premier, and two other senior leaders, 20 petitioners demanded a dialogue and a full accounting for what they called one of the most brutal peacetime massacres in the 20th century. After 10 years, they said, we still cannot say to our loved ones, rest in peace. That, according to Ding Zilin, a People's University professor. The suppression of the democracy demonstrations that drew a million people to Beijing's Tiananmen Square in the spring of 1989 remains one of the most divisive issues in Chinese politics. It is unlikely, however, that there will be a swift resolution. For the past 10 years, each year, human rights representatives have petitioned the leadership, and each year, the leadership has failed to respond. In the United States, Governor Jane Hull in Arizona has ignored international pleas to halt today's scheduled execution of German-born convicted killer Walter Legrand. His brother was put to death last week for the same crime. Germany petitioned the International Court of Justice to halt the execution. The court, which has no enforcement powers in the United States, urged this country to stay the execution. But the governor rejected the recommendation and scheduled the execution for 3 o'clock this afternoon, local time. Legrand's brother Carl was executed last week for the fatal stabbing of a bank manager and the slashing of his throat during a robbery in 1982. Germany's lawsuit in the International Court of Justice alleged that the state of Arizona failed to advise Walter Legrand of his right to consular assistance during his trial. But Arizona officials said that while they violated the Vienna Convention, they did give the Legrands all of the rights any United States citizen would receive. The Justice Department is now lobbying for the ending of the independent counsel law because they say it has fundamental flaws. It comes up before Congress later this year. In a reversal of position for the Clinton administration, Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder said the department opposed renewing the Watergate-era law, which has come under intense scrutiny after the Kenneth Starr investigation of President Clinton. The independent counsel statute, created in 1978, expires on June 30th. Senate and House panels are looking into whether it should be renewed or revised. The Justice Department and Clinton supported the authorization of the law in 1994, but say they have changed their position after having become, quote, more familiar with the statute. And finally today, we note the passing of singer Dusty Springfield at the age of 59. Breast cancer. That's some of the news. I'm Robert Knight.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away on assignment. We expect her back very soon. Three U.S. citizens were kidnapped last week near Colombia's remote northeastern border with Venezuela. According to friends and co-workers, the three were on a mission to help preserve the cultural identity of an indigenous group under the auspices of the Hawaii-based Pacific Cultural Conservancy International. The three are Leheny Ige, the group's director, Ingrid Washinawatak, a Menominee Indian from Wisconsin, and Terrence Freitas, an environmentalist. They were taken last Thursday by armed men in civilian clothes, and no group has yet claimed responsibility for their abduction. An UWA representative who was with the three said he suspected the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and said that the UWA were upset that abductors had not respected their territory. The UWA, a Native American nation of some 8,000 people, won a legal battle against Occidental Petroleum in 1997 that prevented the Los Angeles-based company from exploratory drilling on traditional UWA territory. This latest kidnapping comes at a time when human rights defenders and other social justice activists in Colombia find themselves under unprecedented fire from both guerrillas and right-wing paramilitaries in the long-standing conflict over control of land. In the past few years, human rights activists have been targeted by right-wing paramilitary death squads, many gunned down in front of their offices or in their own homes. This past January, two staff members of the Committee in Solidarity with Political Prisoners were forced from a bus traveling to Bogota and executed by paramilitaries. And a few days before, an armed group forced its way into the offices of the Popular Training Institute in Medellin and kidnapped four staff workers, including the center's director. Paramilitary leader Carlos Castaño issued a communique claiming responsibility for the kidnappings and published an unprecedented collective death threat aimed at all non-governmental organizations working on human rights. The four were subsequently released. Today, to discuss the deteriorating situation in Colombia, we are joined by two representatives of these organizations, as well as a man who for the past several years has waged an arduous battle to help bring peace to Colombia. And we're joined first by Daniel Garcia Peña, who's a guest scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., former High Commissioner for Peace in Colombia from 1995 to 1998. During his time as High Commissioner, he acted as government envoy in the peace negotiations with the guerrillas. He also worked on addressing the issue of paramilitary violence and helped to form the National Peace Council in Colombia. And he joins us from Pacifica Studio WPFW. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Garcia Peña.
Good morning. How are you?
I'd like to start off by asking how these latest kidnappings are fit into and the continuing violence there fit into the general attempt to have a negotiated peace in the Civil War?
Well, unfortunately, we are still not sure exactly who is responsible for these latest abductions, but they are definitely part of a, unfortunately, a very common method used by different armed forces in Colombia to pressure organizations that work either for human rights, in this case for the rights of Indians, of the Uwa Indian population. This has become one of the most blatant violations of international humanitarian law that, as I say, is being used by all the different armed actors in the armed conflict.
I'd also like to bring into the conversation one guest, Agustin Jimenez, who's president of the Committee in Solidarity with Political Prisoners, a human rights organization that assists prisoners who are detained often without trial or legal assistance. After the two CSPP workers were assassinated by paramilitary forces on January 28th of this year, the CSPP has had to close its doors until the Colombian government can provide sufficient guarantees for human rights defenders. Mr. Jimenez also joins us from our studio in WPFW, and he will speak. I understand Mr. Garcia Pena, you'll translate for him. But I'm interested specifically in if he could detail a little bit more of what his organization has undergone in terms of the numbers of people who have been assaulted or kidnapped or subjected to violence, and what the Colombian government is attempting to do about it.
¿Se puede contarnos cuáles han sido los efectos que ha padecido su organización de secuestros, de asesinatos, y cuál ha sido la reacción del gobierno colombiano al respecto?
A ver, nuestra institución ha sido una institución que durante 25 años de trabajo ha recibido muchos ataques de diversas formas, especialmente el ataque dirigido por algunos funcionarios públicos de acusarnos de tener actividades de apoyo a la insurgencia por el trabajo que hacemos y realizamos en las cárceles colombianas vigilando las condiciones de detención de las personas acusadas de delitos políticos.
He says that our organization has been operating for 25 years, and in those 25 years, we have received many attacks from different forms and different groups. We have been often accused by official government representatives of being supportive of the guerrilla groups for the work that we do in Colombian jails in support of political prisoners.
Aunque nuestro trabajo ha sido un trabajo de puertas abiertas y un trabajo que ha estado siempre en concordancia con los diferentes gobiernos del Estado colombiano, esto no ha evitado que en varias ocasiones hayamos sido víctimas de desapariciones forzadas, como en 1990, la desaparición del doctor Alirio Jesús Pedraza en la ciudad de Bogotá, y la muerte en 1995 del doctor Javier Barriga en la ciudad de Cúcuta.
Despite the fact that all of our work is done legally and within the constitutional legal framework in Colombia, we have been victims of several disappearances, most notably in 1990, Alirio Pedraza, that was kidnapped, in 1995, Javier Barriaga, who was also kidnapped and disappeared.
And have any, has the government, excuse me, just one second, has the government found or prosecuted any of the assailants in some of these attacks?
¿El gobierno ha encontrado o ha acusado algunas de las personas de estos ataques?
Actualmente estos dos procesos se encuentran sin ningún esclarecimiento. Uno sucedió en 1990 y uno sucedió en 1995. Precisamente en estos momentos de crisis que tenemos la muerte de otros dos compañeros el 30 de enero de este año, a Julio Ernesto González y Everardo Jesús Puerta, hemos decidido cerrar nuestras oficinas en Colombia hasta que el Estado no nos dé garantías y además no informe qué ha sucedido con estos procesos.
He says that there has been no one has been detained there, even though there are investigations currently underway in both of the cases of 1990 and 1995. There has been no arrest or anything has been cleared up, and as a result of the assassinations of the two members of the organization last January 30th, the organization decided to close their offices in Bogota until the government can give guarantees so they can continue with their work.
Well, I'd like to also bring in Jose Hirong, who's a member of the board of directors for the Popular Training Institute, IPC, a non-governmental human rights organization based in Medellin. The IPC promotes human rights education and collects data on human rights abuses. He also will be speaking through Mr. Garcia Peña's translator. But I'd like to ask him, obviously, Mr. Girón from Medellin, a city which has developed a notorious reputation in terms of drug trafficking. In this country, the American people are often told that the guerrilla organizations that operate protect drug traffickers. What has been your experience in terms of human rights violations and the links between drug traffickers and either the paramilitaries or the guerrilla organizations?
Resulta que Medellín es una ciudad conocida por el narcotráfico y en Estados Unidos se ha escuchado con frecuencia que los grupos guerrilleros tienen muchos nexos con el narcotráfico. ¿Cuál es su experiencia? En su experiencia, ¿cuál han sido o cuáles son esos nexos? ¿Cuál es la relación que puede existir entre el narcotráfico y los grupos de guerrilla o los grupos de paramilitares de extrema derecha?
Bueno, las relaciones que se tienen entre la guerrilla y el narcotráfico es una larga historia en nuestro país. En varias ocasiones se han identificado relaciones muy estrechas entre las fuerzas guerrilleras, particularmente las FARC, con la protección de cultivos. Se cree que es una fuente de financiación importante en este momento. En el caso de los paramilitares, pues la historia es también muy reciente. Bien es hecho que es conocido que Carlos Castaño conformó el famoso grupo de los Pepes, que era un grupo que se dedicó a protegerse de Pablo Escobar.
Yes, he says that the relations between guerrillas and narcos there's a long history, a very complex history, that there's a lot of information about very close ties between the FARC and the protection of coca crops, and that this has become one of the prime sources of their financing. As far as the paramilitary groups goes, there's a lot that in recent history that shows that they have also very close ties. He mentioned the case of Carlos Castaño, the leader of the paramilitary groups that conformed in the early 1990s, a group called Los Pepes, that was organized by different cartels to protect themselves from Pablo Escobar.
And what is the... Siga, por favor.
Esta relación pues ha sido, como le explicaba largamente, y ha sido un factor indica el gran lo complejo que es la situación de violencia en Colombia, en donde se aparecen como factores de violencia pues circunstancias de orden social, pero aparece todo eso dentro de un manto del narcotráfico que está prácticamente incidiendo en actividades de uno u otro actor armado.
He said this is all part of the complexity of violence in Colombia, in which there is an underlying social and political root causes to the violence, but this is all mixed up or mixed in with the drug trafficking phenomena that has fueled violence on all sides of the armed conflict.
Como ha sido conocido internacionalmente, recientemente Carlos Castaño secuestró a cuatro de nuestros investigadores. Aunque él claramente les dijo no tener ningún nexo con el narcotráfico y que tampoco afirma pertenecer a organizaciones paramilitares, sino que su organización se llama Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia. Entonces, él quiere hacer una separación entre lo que es su movimiento y lo que son otras organizaciones paramilitares que él dice son muy numerosas en Colombia.
As it was known internationally, Carlos Castaño recently kidnapped four of the researchers, the investigators of our organization. And even though Mr. Castaño said that he was not, and that his organization was not linked to the drug trafficking, that he was not a paramilitary group, but rather a group of self-defense, of peasant self-defense, he did admit to the fact that other of the paramilitary groups do have close ties to the drug lords.
Él afirma que a nuestros compañeros que fueron secuestrados les señaló que Su proyecto es un
sí,
proyecto...
Señor Girón, si lo puedo interrumpir por un minuto, porque nos falta más que 30 segundos. I'd just like to ask Mr. Garcia-Peña one last question. We have about 30 seconds. What is the atmosphere now in the process of these peace negotiations in terms of human rights? Have things gotten better since the change in government in Colombia, or have things gotten worse?
Well, unfortunately, they've not gotten better. I don't know. I'm not sure if you can say they have gotten worse, but... The fact is that there was a lot of hope placed in the peace process with the new administration. Things began quite optimistically towards peace talks. Unfortunately, precisely due to the fact of the paramilitary violence in the beginning of January, the talks were suspended. At this moment, there are no formal talks going on. The date of April 20th had been set supposedly to begin talks once again, and we all hope that one of the main issues, that the central issue, in the beginning of the talks will be human rights and will be international humanitarian law. But unfortunately, that has not yet been the case. And on the contrary, these last few weeks have seen the increased attacks on civilian population, on human rights workers. And we unfortunately would have to admit that in the near future, these will probably continue.
Well, I'd like to thank all three of our guests, Daniel Garcia Peña, scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and former High Commissioner for Peace in Colombia, Agustin Jimenez, president of the Committee in Solidarity with Political Prisoners, and Jose Girón, a member of the Board of Directors for Popular Training Institute in Colombia. And we'll be continuing to monitor what happens in the developing, both in the negotiations and the continuing conflict there. Thank you for being with us. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away on assignment. Indonesian dictator B.J. Habibie said this week that he wants East Timor to decide on the question of autonomy before national elections on June 7th. This according to Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer. Downer said that an autonomy package could be finalized during the next round of UN-sponsored talks on East Timor between Indonesia, Portugal, and the East Timorese this coming March 7th to 9th. We're joined now by journalist and human rights activist Alan Nairn, who with Amy Goodman interviewed East Timorese resistance leader Xanana Gusmao early this morning. Gusmao was moved from an Indonesian prison to house arrest in Jakarta this past month after Indonesia announced a reversal in its policy towards East Timor and said that it would consider granting independence to the occupied territory. Welcome, Alan, and could you tell us a little bit about the interview that we're about to hear?
Thanks. This was taped at 3:30 this morning by phone with Xanana under house arrest and a phone hookup with Amy in Peru. This is the first U.S. radio interview with Xanana for years. He was in the hills, then recently taken out of the main prison. There are a few terms he uses in the interview that I just want to explain to listeners. He refers to the SAGI, which is the Indonesian military intelligence, the ABRI, that's the Indonesian armed forces, Falantil, those are the Timorese guerrillas that Xanana leads, as well as leading the CNRT, which is the political umbrella group there. He refers to the consultation process. That's the process by which the Timorese will decide whether they want autonomy as part of Indonesia or whether they want independence.
And so now we're going to turn to this interview, the first ever interview of the East Timorese guerrilla leader with U.S. journalists.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Lima, Peru, and I'm joined by freelance journalist Alan Nairn in the studios in New York. Today we're going to be interviewing the rebel leader of East Timor, Xanana Gusmao, who is joining us from the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, where he's under house arrest. Alan Nairn and I went to East Timor in 1990, 1991, and 1994. Until 1992, Xanana Gusmao lived in the mountains of East Timor, fighting the Indonesian army, which had occupied the small island country since 1975. In 1992, the Indonesian army captured Xanana Gusmao, sentenced him to life in prison, a term which was later commuted to 20 years. Then a few months ago, the Indonesian regime announced it would grant East Timor autonomy, and if the Timorese didn't accept that, it might grant them independence. Well, a few weeks ago, Xanana Gusmao was moved from prison to house arrest. Xanana is a Nelson Mandela-like figure in East Timor. World leaders have called for his full release. In the meantime, he's meeting with leaders around the world. On Friday, March 5th, he will meet with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Xanana Gusmao, this is your first U.S. radio interview. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Xanana Gusmao.
I'm very happy, and I'm grateful to the Pacific Radio to get this opportunity to talk to everybody about the East Timor problem. And on behalf of my people, I would like to thank to Alan M. and to Amy Gordon and people who could brought to the international community the real problem of East Timor. And I thank you very much, friends, my friends.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us, and we want to start right away by, and it's truly remarkable to be able to speak to you as you are still under house arrest in Jakarta.
Xanana, this is Alan Nairn. Could you tell us who has created these militia groups, these paramilitaries that are now attacking civilians in East Timor?
We have concluded that it is a military intelligence service. They organized the civilians, and they gave them weapons to intimidate the population in order to create an appearance that in East Timor the situation is uncontrollable, and that to show to the international community that it would be some threat of civil war. And in our opinion, it is the military intelligence service called SKE, Satuan Gabungan Intelligence, founded and consolidated by COPASUS. And we want to say that it is a third part in the process that wants to create the sensation that of an instability in East Timor and to force the Indonesian society, the international community, to accept that in East Timor, if there are a referendum or there are an independence choice, it would be a civil war.
If the people of East Timor had a free choice in a referendum, do you believe they would choose independence?
Oh. I don't believe, I'm sure that only a few people who had received privilege during these 23 years who want integration because they are so well in this time and they are afraid of being killed or being suffering reprisal from the independentist part. I already assured them we are trying to say to them that nothing would happen to them if East Timor came to be independent. And I know that the great majority of our people are asking for immediate independence, and we are trying to say that we have to accept a transitional period under the umbrella of the United Nations to prepare ourselves to the day we are waiting for.
And Shanana, in this January, President Habibie of Indonesia said that if the people of East Timor reject autonomy, that Indonesia would consider granting independence to East Timor. Do you believe that the Indonesian government is truly willing to grant independence to East Timor, that it is truly ready to do that?
I don't see the question from this angle. I see the question from another angle, that President Habibie has to be aware that he has committed to the international community, not to the East Timorese community. I don't worry about his sincerity or about the sincerity of the Indonesian government. The Indonesian government has committed to the international community that if East Timor's people reject the autonomy, we would have granted the full independence.
Shanana, what do you plan to say to Madeleine Albright on Friday?
It is a difficult question to be answered because, but I can say to you that I will explain the real situation in the territory. I will explain the role of a third party in the process, and I will explain how we see about the consultation process. I will tell her about the need of presence of the UN police force. And about the mechanism we think that it could be possible to be held there.
Will you be calling for United Nations troops to come into East Timor or just United Nations unarmed personnel?
United Nations police force, police presence.
And why do you think that is necessary?
Because we volunteer, we are ready to be disarmed, and we ask for the disarmament of all parties.
Including the ABRI, the Indonesian Armed Forces?
Including the East Timorese serving in ABRI and the paramilitary groups who fought against us. while ABRI has to be withdrawn from East Timor.
So you would then call for ABRI to withdraw from East Timor and for a UN police force to come into East Timor?
Yes. We see that there would not be any peaceful consultation process if before the both parties are not disarmed. It is the best way to assure everybody that it would not be any chance of any possibility of civil war there. And if we get the UN police force there and a process of ceasefire and disarmament between East Timorese, ABRI has to withdraw from East Timor to permit that the atmosphere is favorable to a consultation process.
And how long would you expect the UN to stay in East Timor?
During the consultation process, and maybe for 6 months, because 6 months more, because we have to consolidate the reconciliation process. We have to prove to each other that we are sincere in our commitments in the reconciliation, in the peaceful or before the consultation process. We have to consolidate the mutual confidence between East Timorese, and I feel that 6 months would be enough to the UN police force to be there.
After the 6 months are over and the UN police force leaves, what would happen then?
In our view of the process, after the disarmament, the UN police force would select, instruct, and teach the candidates coming from volunteer from East Timorese serving in the ABRI, and policemen would have been formed by Indonesian government, and create a police corps from East Timorese, be sent to all the territory. And I think that if we get a peaceful process in the consultation period, we would get also a peaceful atmosphere before the consultation process, and after 6 months, we all already can work together to avoid any violence and any attempts of conflict.
The Indonesian government has said that they will not accept a referendum in East Timor. Without a referendum, is there any way to determine the will of the people of East Timor? Is there any way to make a decision?
We are trying to find out a mechanism in which the aspect of being democratic and representative would be assured, because if the choice is not democratic, democratic, it would not satisfy anybody. And we are trying to study, to seek for a better mechanism.
What kind of mechanism?
Representative elections to choose representatives to a consultative assembly, and the consultative assembly will decide if East Timorese people accept or reject the proposal of autonomy.
You have been meeting with various Indonesian generals from the Indonesian armed forces. Have you discussed with them the question of why they are creating and arming the militias in East Timor?
They have many arguments, but we already saw that there are some factions of ABRI who doesn't accept the psychological sense of being of losing this war. And I mean the veterans of the war, and maybe, and I'm afraid it is true that the Compassos faction, the military service, intelligence service faction.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking to Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with journalist Alan Nairn. We're interviewing Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor. He's under house arrest in Indonesia.
The Kopassus was for many years trained by the government of the United States, by the American military, in intelligence, sniper techniques, psychological warfare, etc. What impact did this U.S. support for the Indonesian army have on the conduct of the Indonesian army in Timor and within Indonesia itself?
I think that the impact is preparing Indonesian killers to go to East Timor to kill and to kill East Timor's people, because the Kopassus is not a combat army, but is an intelligence service of ABRI, and they in the war, in these 23 years of occupation, Kopassus are the are involved in capturing, torturing, killing and jailing people, and I think that the impact of being trained by the U.S. Project of training of military education was so bad, very bad in East Timor.
There are now proposals in the U.S. Congress to cut off, to end all weapons and ammunition and training for the Indonesian army, to stop supplying them. Do you think that would be a good idea, to stop supplying all training, all weapons to the ABRI?
I think it is a good idea, but it is not enough. I think that as I told you, the military intelligence service is doing very bad in East Timor now, and I would prefer that the U.S. government could pressure the Indonesian government to put an end of the SCG's presence in East Timor, because if MBB had presented to East Timorese people two options, there is no more basis, argument to the SCG to stay there. And if, I know, I'm sure, we all East Timorese are sure that if SCG is brought out from East Timor, we East Timorese can work together, can meet each other to prepare ourselves to this crucial period of consultation process.
Shanana Gushmao, do you plan to run for president of an independent East Timor?
Please, I mean, don't ask me that question. I'm trying to every hour of this week and of next month to think about how difficult is the time, how great is the challenges of we are facing, challenges before us now. And please don't ask me about being president, because and there are people killed by the military, by the civilians, armed by the military, and it is not yet time to ask me that question. Sorry.
Shanana, in November of 1991, the days leading up to the procession of November 12, 1991, from the Motael Church to the Santa Cruz Cemetery, the procession that was massacred by the Indonesian army, what was your expectation? How did you think the Indonesian army would respond to that peaceful procession to the cemetery? What were you expecting them to do?
Frankly, I didn't expect so brutal reaction from ABRI. I thought that because East Timor was in the front of the pages in the world, because the failed visit of parliamentarian delegation, Portuguese parliamentarian delegation, I thought that they could restrain themselves, but after the massacre, I was sad, but I was not. I was not. I was very sad, but I accepted that it was a consequence of our struggle, and like that massacre, there were many, many others without being known, without being been investigated, and yes, I was very, very surprised by the brutal reaction of Aubrey.
Why do you think the Aubrey opened fire on the crowd that day?
It is usual to Aubrey to think that stimulus can be afraid with the death, with the wound, with death, and we would surrender. And the Aubrey generals never thought about the conscience of people, but about the force, the repression could destroy any spirit of fighting, any determination of continuing to struggle, and it is their failures. They never consider our conscience. They never consider our innermost. They only thought that if they punish us, we automatically give up with our ideals, with our aims. I think it is what happened.
Do you think the massacre and what happened afterward was a turning point?
I think so. I think so because before the massacre, we tried very heavily to say to the world that many, many people were killed, that nobody was apparently very, not so many people believe in us. And the image you took in the massacre could prove and could could show to the international community that not only that situation, but maybe it. The situation like that maybe had happened in Estima too.
Do you think that the United States government owes East Timor compensation for supporting the Indonesian army in its genocide against the people of East Timor?
What we are trying to say to the United States is that please tell the Indonesian government to stop the violence in East Timor and to withdraw from East Timor the military intelligence service, because we believe that this is the third part to explain an important role to disturb the solution and to discredit the Indonesian government itself.
During the Indonesian army occupation of East Timor, 200,000 people, one-third of the original population, have been killed. What has this done to the society in East Timor? What effect has it had on the people there?
The impact.
Yes.
The impact is what I sometimes say. The very important impact is that the occupation was the military occupation had united East Timorese, had consolidated the nationalist spirit and the stronger patriotism.
You've been listening to Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor, speaking to us from house arrest in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia.
There is no silence deep enough.
That interview you've just heard through the wonders of telecommunication between Amy Goodman in Peru, Xanana Gusmão in Jakarta, and Alan Nairn here in New York was taped at 3 o'clock this morning. One of the first extensive interview with the Timorese guerrilla leader. That does it for today's broadcast. For a copy of this show, please call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion with help from Donna Neiman. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Joe Gill engineered from Washington. A special thanks to Robert Knight for the headlines. From the studios of WBAI in New York City, I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!